You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Hello, Majority Report listeners, Matt here. Coming up for you today, we have a great show. Sam is live in Vegas with Cliff Schechter. And later on in the show, he talked with Judge Oliver Diaz. And you might be wondering why I'm interjecting here at the top of the show, and there's two reasons. Number one is to remind you all to nominate The Majority Report in the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. We want to be nominated in the politics/news category and in the People's Choice category. Try to stick with those two categories. I believe you can only nominate us in those in two categories. So let's make it those two. If it's spread apart multiple categories, we might not get nominated for anything, and we don't want that happening. And number two, after voting for us, The Majority Report in politics/news and People's Choice at podcastawards.com, number two is tonight for the vice presidential debate. Sam and Cliff will be doing a live running commentary during the debate from Vegas. So tune in, majority.fm. We'll have more details as I get them as well from Sam. And hope you enjoy. Here's the show. Sam is live in Vegas.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 11th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. I am broadcasting live from the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Here for the Mass Torts Conference, and also to spend, or I should say, lose my child's college money. Not just her spending money, but the entire tuition, of course. On this, the vice presidential debate day, on today's program, little Paul Ryan primer, little telecom immunity talk. Remember that? Oh, yes. Touch on this Benghazi story that the Republicans are now holding hearings on in the House. And hopefully we'll have a couple of guests from the conference here, although for some reason it's not looking so great at the moment. However, ladies and gentlemen, and I know you're all going to be excited about this, sitting across the table from me, presumably with much better, well, I guess discretion, I don't know what to say, luck at the tables, but certainly discretion, is Mr. Cliff Schechter. He won't get his theme song because, of course, it's not Friday. He'll get that tomorrow. But Cliff Schechter is here with me now in the Bellagio Hotel.
Hey, Sammy. How are you?
I'm doing well, Cliff. Thank you for joining us.
The way you say Bellagio, it's so sexy.
It's, I think that's the Italian pronunciation. I'm not sure. So, Cliff, I'm hoping to talk to a couple other people here about some...
Important people?
Well, a couple of my guests apparently fell through.
I found out,
it's true.
Late-breaking
guest. I have some other guests that were scheduled for later in the program, but I'm not... I listen, I don't want to imply in any way that I'm not happy to have you here. Of course I am.
Oh, go ahead and imply. It's cool.
Well, I think I've implied it.
Yeah.
I think it's been implied.
I got the implication.
I am so happy to have you here because right now I'd be talking to myself. Cliff, all right, couple of things.
Yep.
I think I said this on the show on Monday as I was leaving, but I cannot go anywhere now. You know, you must go through this too because people know that you're a political commentator in your sort of civilian life.
My non-military.
Yeah. You're non, yes, you're yeah. You're non sort of like...
No, I got you. I was just being a...
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so I drop my kid off at school. Really, it doesn't matter what I do. If I go see the dentist, everybody in every part of my life on... At the tables Tuesday night.
I'm telling that story, by the way.
Okay, all right, we'll tell that story. But before we get there, every single person I know has stopped me, has emailed me, my wife, friends I haven't talked to in 10 years, literally old college alumni that I haven't spoken to in maybe 25 years.
Empty chairs, long
everybody
furniture.
Is sending me emails like... what's up with the polls? What's going on? And it's, first of all, it's incredibly depressing to me on one level because it's like there's so many people out there who are not paying attention to the right things.
Yes.
They get involved in politics only, in the two weeks.
It's stuff just, that the networks sell you, yeah.
It's just amazing because as far as I can tell, most of this poll stuff was bullshit anyways.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, I
can say that. Why am I hesitating?
Yeah, why are you holding back? It's bullshit.
It's your radio station anyway.
Exactly. I'm the one who's going to find out the SEC. Not you, you bastard.
So, just give me your sense on it, because I think, like, I've been saying that I think a lot of those polls are, statistically speaking, just a function of, yes, there was probably some slight variance, but... Primarily, it was just basically recalculating how they interpreted the Republican turnout was going to be.
Right.
From total depression to not total depression.
Right.
That changes your likely...
Plus, considering the Republican demographic, you have to kind of figure out how many of them will die before the election, too.
Indeed. And that may have been... Romney gave them another gasp of life. But the whole thing is, that's a subjective assumption that you make in terms of determining who is the pool of likely voters.
That's exactly right. Look, when you look at... And I used to do this polling stuff, even though I'm not going to say it's my strength. You want to look at is you want to look at certain demographics because those are important. And so I think there was a poll at some point that showed like Mitt Romney a few months ago getting like 30% of the African American vote. You see something like that, you can pretty much throw that poll away. But the rest of it in terms of who's going to turn out Republican versus Democrat, you know, you're basing it on past years. You're sort of trying to figure out who's more enthusiastic.
Right.
It's not a perfect, it's far from a perfect science. The rule, and I'd say this because my mom gets freaked out, and other people that I know, good, you know, especially, let's face it, I mean, some of the New York Jews I know, I mean,
yes.
They're like, well, they're watching an endless loop of Seinfeld and locking themselves behind closed doors. But you have to look at a poll as a snapshot in time, and B, it's one of many. You need to look at the, I like using this word, preponderance of polls if you want to get an idea of what's going on. So was there movement towards Mitt Romney? Absolutely. But, you know, if you look at any one poll, including the one that'll show, like, Obama up 15 points somewhere, that's not helpful either. You look at where they are overall. Overall, right now, there's pretty much a tied race. And from what everybody is saying, we have these long, sort of these 7-day rolling polls. The samples for Romney on Friday and Saturday were like through the roof. To figure it takes a few days for things to process. The jobs numbers that you and I cooked up together in a back room helped bring back, and with the Rothschilds, let's give credit, and Michael Moore.
And I'll tell you something, folks. That is a weird. You get all those folks in a room together. It is. It's strange.
I mean, when the Rothschilds bring their beer bong, that place can just get wacky. So you know, when the jobs numbers, so those 2 days later, 3 days later, those polls start going back towards Obama, the daily samples, and a bunch of them have said this, Gallup and others. So, in the end, let's see where it shakes out. Obviously, it's hard to say where exactly it's going to shake out because we've got another big event tonight in the vice presidential debate. But my guess is, you know, Mitt Romney may have picked up two permanent points, and my guess right now would be instead of being up 4-6, that Obama's probably up more like 2-3 now. But again, I have to say this, being from the state of Ohio, the very important thing is, if everybody forgets, remember back to those glory days of 2000 and flip it in the other direction. The Electoral College is what determines this thing, as we painfully remember. So
that now, and the Supreme Court.
Right. And when the Electoral College has issues, the Supreme Court steps in and gives it to the Republicans. But assuming that all works out this time, and that there's not complete craziness, and I'm not saying there can't, who the hell knows, but they'll be in violent revolution and there'll be more fun. Seriously, what... I don't see, right now, the firefighters and police, I've seen this everywhere, this is yes, it's anecdotal, but it's also in the polls, are so pissed right now because of John Kasich in Ohio trying to take away their collective bargaining rights. Groups that haven't supported Democrats for a decade, two decades are now behind, I think I've said this to you before, the Fraternal Order of Police endorsing Sherrod Brown.
Right.
First time they endorsed a Democrat since Metzenbaum back in 88. The firefighters, I think, for the first time since 96 with Clinton. You've got, on the presidential side, you've got that. You've got the auto bailout. These things combine, and then the Bain ads. Oh, my God, we shouldn't run those because they're terrible, and Cory Booker might get upset. And they kept running those.
Right.
So you've got, what's the one region of the country where Obama was winning the white working class, at least as of like a week ago? The Midwest. Because he's made it so that he is on their side. That means in states like Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, I still don't even believe are on the playing field. And states like Ohio, Iowa, which are two pretty important states, that's Obama's lead, And so I don't see, maybe Romney, I know I've been talking too long, gained like 2 points or 3 points, and I think he did. I think it was an Obama plus 8 in Ohio. I now think it's an Obama plus 4. Like a poll just came out yesterday, showed Obama, I think, up 5. Plus 4, plus 5 is a good place to be. You're only up plus 1, I get more worried you're going to steal it.
He only won Ohio by 4 in 2008.
That's right.
I mean, so... What is shocking to me is...
When he won the entire election. I mean, he catch up by 7 points. And he's probably... He had a chance at doing that before. I don't know that happens now. So, disproportionately... We're looking at two very important Midwestern states, Ohio being probably even more important because, obviously, it's electoral size. You see Romney spending a lot of time in Iowa and Ohio. I have a real hard time. He can win Florida. He can win North Carolina. I'm not even sure he's going to win Florida, but I'm giving them to him right now. He can even win Colorado. And most of the other, he'll lose. So important to keep that and people to keep all of that in perspective.
You know, the reason why I was shaking my head when you were saying that was just...
Because you don't like me. I know.
No. It's because... The bar for President Obama to be on the side of those union workers and whatnot is pretty low, only because guys like Kasich and the Republicans have such antipathy towards these.
Right. Kasich got 40% plus, maybe 42 or some crazy number of union votes, which makes you slap yourself on the head and say, what the F are you guys doing? But they, they learned their lesson from what he did when he came in.
Right. All it takes at this point to be on the side of unions is to not aggressively attack them.
Right.
And even then,
that's a whole topic for another show and how sad that is.
But that's the only thing that occurred to me. But you're right. So the poll thing, I guess it's possible, President Obama could come on to the next two debates and say...
Shoot a snot rocket or throw up on himself.
I don't know. I mean, but...
Start acting out the video that Republicans want to maybe yell, goddamn America, start pounding the table. Because it's theoretically possible. I'm just saying, if people want to know
we are two people who were rather explicit about how poorly we thought President Obama did in the debate.
I think, honestly... that the chair that Clint Eastwood was yelling at did better than Barack Obama. I mean, I could go on and on. I could make jokes, and I won't. I honestly think that was the most terrible performance. And I've been watching these things probably since about 92 and paying attention.
Yeah.
I would say that's the worst performance I've seen that I can remember. Bush's in 2004 was definitely a close second, that first one against Kerry. But I think this is the worst that
I think it's also the reason why this thing has had such legs in terms of people talking about it for so long is because there was... there were such high expectations. I mean, from my perspective, my problem with the debate you know, he stunk, whatever. My problem is it's just so frustrating because I saw this, for instance, and this will give us a chance to segue in. Now, we've got to figure out how we're actually going to physically cover the debate tonight live.
Did you hear that, folks? Live.
We're going to do it live. The only problem is, like, in here,
riffing,
where we are, I think, is going to be, there's going to be, like, they're going to be having a cocktail party. We're in the sort of, like, convention hall, and I think they're going to be having a cocktail party at that time.
You think we should get a couple drunk lawyers on the air to talk about it?
Which would make it rather difficult. It will be interesting to
see. We need to live tweet and live talk this thing through. I think we do.
I agree. We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Okay.
Oh, I think your first guest is getting here, like your first real person. Was that the guy just waving to you?
I didn't even see anybody waving
to me.
I
thought some guy just was.
No,
okay,
I figured I was getting
kicked out. Okay. I'm the replacement refs.
So, you know, but this is a story I want to talk. We'll probably have other stuff to talk about tomorrow. But, and I was going to have you on at the end of the show to promote.
You keep joking, but I'm just kidding around. Samuel, it's all love.
No, I know, but you know how upsetting that is for the audience.
Even though you got
they
me
don't
lose,
know, they,
you
they,
got me to lose $90 at a table the other night.
We'll tell that story,
we'll
tell that story. Maybe we'll save that story for tomorrow. But so there's a piece in Politico.
Thank God my wife doesn't listen to this show.
But believe me, that's exactly why when my wife says, like, do you feel badly? I listen to the show. No.
Yeah.
No.
And like it was for my wife, it was like a novelty when I first started doing, you know, when she first met me and I was doing TV and radio, she like listen and whatever, read my columns. Now I can write a column like I just did this past week where literally I explicitly quote an idea of hers about how Obama should take on the debate. You know, the two Romneys, the public Romney versus the one behind closed doors. She hasn't read it. She's
good.
Like, I'm sick of you. We got kids and bills to pay and, you know. You're annoying. She's right. I am annoying. So
no,
I understand.
No. I'm totally in her corner. I totally understand.
I annoy myself.
So let's talk about this Politico piece that Paul Ryan is not the weapon that the House Democrats had anticipated he would be. It's basically saying, well, and I think we talked about this. Paul Ryan represented a golden opportunity.
Yes.
Where we saw inklings of it when Joe Biden came out and said in that coffee shop the week that Paul Ryan was, that I guarantee you, flat out guarantee, not going to touch Social Security.
I knew where you're going, yeah,
right?
Because I agree with you so much on this. That
and, yeah, so well, I mean, this is basically our portfolio. This is where
required disclosure. I consult for Social Security Works because I actually believe in Social Security.
Well, yes, that's
let's throw that out there.
That's insane.
Because I forget sometimes, and I don't do it on purpose.
I understand. I don't. I mean, I'm not concerned. So, so the point being that. And it wasn't just Social Security, it was also Medicare. And it was also, in fact, the entire Ryan budget. The entire Ryan budget would cut just about everything in such a draconian way because, of course, it's a tax, discretionary spending. And discretionary spending is only 12% of our entire budget as it is. So when you cut 25%,
yes.
You cut to whatever 25% of the budget
thing,
and all comes from discretionary spending, I mean, that's just enormous.
You cut discretionary spending by something like 92%, I think was the calculus. I mean, some ridiculous. I mean, it's the thing is, I mean, it's Paul Krugman. You don't need to, it's a fraud. It's a joke. It's not serious. Paul Ryan is exactly the Washington creation of somebody who's taken seriously that wouldn't be taken seriously in any other part of the universe that we inhabit. Here's the thing, Sam, and I want to make this point very explicitly. While I detest much of Republican policy, when it comes to the public relations side, the stuff that I do, when they stand up there and the Democrats sound like a jumble of stuff, we say, well, we'll cut taxes on this, but we won't cut taxes on that, and the Republicans say very clearly, we will not raise taxes on anyone. We will cut taxes. End of story. It's not exactly true, but that's what they say. It's a clear message. People can understand it. Now imagine on the flip side, if the Democrats would say, we will not cut Social Security or Medicare $1. 100%
period.
Of it. 100%.
No tweaking,
no messing. Exactly. When they start going with slash versus cut and this versus that, people get mixed messages, and that's what allows Republicans to jump in and skew and lie about
and
what
look,
they're doing.
This isn't just a question of messaging. President
obviously,
Obama.
Morally, I don't want to say that I don't think it's morally the right thing to do. Of course it is. But I just want to say in terms of messaging, too, it couldn't be easier than just making that statement. You'd look strong and you'd stand up against the guys. And then the Ryan budget would be a much more of an albatross because it would be like, we are protecting it. He is cutting it. It is that simple. He can't make a... Go ahead.
Let me. I want to rephrase. It's the point about messaging. They are actually messaging an accurate description of their policy prescriptions. That's the problem.
I know.
In this
You're
instance.
Right. You're right.
Is that the message becomes very easy if you can bring yourself to say, I don't want to leave myself any room to cut Social Security or Medicare. The president obviously will not do that.
Right. You know who is a great example of this? The other night, in your home state, Elizabeth Warren stood up against...
Last night.
I should have said that. Against that completely inane, cosmopolitan, posing naked goofball who doesn't... And
hey, listen, I don't need anybody, coming up from New York and, speaking...
Whatever, he's probably a Red Sox fan. Anyway. He's such a dick.
You're
going to have to cut that out, too. So, in any case, he got up and, they're going to cut $750 billion, and she said in strong words, I hope Obama was watching, President Obama.
Three quarters of a trillion.
Cuts from Medicare, and she kept pointing out that was not true.
$760 billion.
Yes, that it wasn't coming from people's services. It was coming from insurance companies, and no matter how many times he said it, it wasn't true. And she looked at the camera, as I remember, and she said in very strong language, I will not cut Social Security or Medicare $1. I don't know if she said it in those exact words, but I will not cut it one bit, or whatever it was she said. She said it straightforward, in strong language. She's going to win that race.
I think she's going to win that race anyways. It's good to see her improving, frankly, as she's in that debate. And that's my... I'm sorry. We were going to hear that noise occasionally, folks. That's just the way it's going to go.
Sam needs his speed every once in a while. That reminds him.
Yeah, that reminds me that I'm still alive. But the president, one of the things that he failed to do during the debate, he didn't seem to even make an attempt to do this, is to tie Romney into the congressional Republicans and Paul Ryan.
Yes.
And the Social Security thing was just absurd. We both, in addition, and we've talked about this, both agree, subsequent to that, on the president's campaign website, they clarified and basically said the same thing.
Right.
They said, well, it is different because Mitt Romney wants to privatize Social Security and we just want to tweak it.
Right.
And this notion of, look, we know what tweaking means. It means cuts ranging from 3% to 10% to 25%. Who knows? It could be.
If they go for the 2004 Ryan plan, it would have been between a third and a half.
But I'm talking about the Democrats.
No, I know. I'm just getting another shot at Ryan because it's fun. No, but you're right. You're right.
And so this tweaking is something that's just, it's very worrisome. And, people are obsessed about the polls right now. This is something that you should be worried about as well.
Yeah.
And it also, frankly, is part of the reason why the president finds himself in this situation. To the extent that there's anything that is not clear about his election, it is because they have failed to draw the easiest and starkest contrast, and it is because, frankly, on other issues too,
because he should have stood up and that women's issues were not discussed in that debate. He should have stood up there and said and said very strongly that we believe in a woman's right to choose. I believe women have the right to birth control and things of that sort. I mean, you can message it however you want, probably better than that. But the argument would have been very simple, and he would have had like 98% of women agreeing with him.
But that's a total tactical failure in that he didn't raise those things. But Social Security was raised.
You're right.
Medicare was raised. These things are on the table, and he refuses to take the type of position, even though it would be clearly electorally beneficial for them. I mean, in the same way, let's put it this way. In the same way that we saw Cory Booker and Harold Ford and Bill Clinton and Ed Rendell, the dude from Pennsylvania.
God, I used to like him so much.
Really?
Well, he's mayor of Philadelphia when I was an undergrad in Philly at Penn. And so he used to come back and visit. He's the back-slapping fun guy. Like, he's such a fun, cool guy. And now he's taking all these crappy positions, and
I'm
mad.
Well, in the same way that all these guys said, don't attack Bain, it's not going to work. the fact that it wasn't going to work was a fig leaf for, hey, we just slow the roll here. We don't want this idea of vulture capitalism, even though it was introduced by Newt Gingrich. We don't want
this. And Rick Perry.
We don't. Oh, thank
Absolutely. If anybody out there knows a call girl, Newt Gingrich is probably, you know, well, you may want to thank him that way. Send it his way.
Send him something from Tiffany.
That and maybe two pies of pizza.
In the same way that they come out and use as a fig leaf that this will not work electorally, don't say it. It really is, they are afraid of a mass of public opinion moving against these people in a big way. And I think it's the same thing with Social Security and Medicare for at least President Obama. Even though he must know electorally, and certainly Joe Biden did, even though he must know electorally that this is a winner, even though their desire to cut Social Security is so intense, and I'm not saying, and people should understand what I'm saying here, it's not that President Obama sits in a room and is like, I've got to cut Social Security. It's just that he is bathed, he is awash in a bubble and a mentality that Social Security needs to be cut.
Yeah.
And
it's just like a simple conventional wisdom thing that makes no sense, but to be taken seriously in certain places in Washington, you're supposed to say that.
Right. And
because there's no other ways, obviously, if you were wanting to, let's say, cut down on the deficit. Bill Clinton obviously cut the hell out of Social Security. Oh, wait, he didn't do that. That's right. I mean, there are 15 different ways I can rattle off the top of my head right now to cut the budget. And, you know, I mean, it's so easy. It's ridiculous. Not to mention Social Security doesn't need to be touched in any way till 2033. 2033. Folks, keep that number in mind.
Yes, Social Security cannot contribute one dime to the deficit.
That's a great point, too.
Statutorily speaking, it cannot contribute. The reason why they want to cut it is just to slow the rate in which the U.S. government has to pay off the Treasury bills that it's due. So it doesn't cut the deficit. It just simply is a way.
I have another theory, too.
What's that?
I think it gives Pete Peterson an erection.
Well, yes, this is all
at his age, if you lose your Cialis for a night, if you can think of cutting Social Security, you know, it kind of gets you ready.
You know, remind me about this, because Matt Iglesias wrote a piece about Pete Peterson.
Yes, he did. It was a good piece.
Yes. I want to talk about that tomorrow. That'll give us something to talk about, because I also want to talk about this.
That's the most absurd thing, is that he spent $438 or something million dollars already on his crusade to cut Social Security, that this guy's so obsessed with it. And that's why I made maybe I'll get in trouble with the SEC again for saying erection. I don't know. But that this guy is so –
he has erected an entire edifice.
That's what I meant.
Fake newspaper. Institution to cut Social Security.
He's so obsessed with it, even though he's a billionaire. He's so obsessed with making other people suffer. It makes me honestly have to wonder what, you know, he needs to see a shrink, quite frankly. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but he needs to see like 14 shrinks. He doesn't know what it is that he needs to torture and hurt other people.
Listen, I'll tell you something. I mean, it's an ideological fight for him, but remember the implications here now, okay? If you cut Social Security, the smallest cost of a living adjustment that they're talking about would provide essentially a 10% cut over the lifetime of a senior citizen.
That's right.
And Social Security. The implications of this are, and it will increase the poverty rate, I think they say, by about 7%. 7% of seniors will drop through poverty. The percentages of all these seniors, you know, if 7% fall through the poverty line, that means that there's also a commensurate drop in the incomes of all these other seniors. Now, who makes that up?
What are you saying?
Well, who's going to make up that difference?
Oh.
I mean, it's going to be their kids.
Yeah.
And not just in terms of, I'm not talking about in terms of increased payroll taxes. I'm talking about in their after-tax income is going to be spent on helping their parents.
That's true.
And
unless they know a good guy who can get that money over to the Grand Caymans.
Right. And they may not fill that gap totally. But what it's going to do is it's also going to basically increase the pressure, the coercive pressure of capital in this country on the workers, right? Yes. I need this money more than I did before.
That's exactly right.
I have less mobility. I have less freedom.
Right.
I am more strapped. I'm going to have to work harder. I mean, all of those things. And so there is benefits. I think rather than just simply say it's Pete Peterson's masochism, I think there is benefits to that class in that it continues to subjugate everybody else and creates this sort of, you know, it really creates further delineation between the wealthy aristocrats and the
rest of us.
And the rest of us. So
I still think he's an a-hole, though.
Okay, yes, and I would agree with that, too. But getting back to the point, tonight we have the debate. We're hoping to see Joe Biden do what?
Let's see. A couple things we're hoping to see him do. First of all, in clear language, the language of our forefathers, English, that people can understand, not up and down, all around, looking down. Hey, I rhymed there. That was pretty good. Sadly, the president did. We want him to clearly state what it is they stand for in straightforward language. And anything that Paul Ryan says to the contrary, because you know he's coming in with the $716 billion cut to Medicare,
right?
Because he does that. He's going to come in and attack them for Simpson Bowles, even though he walked away from it, which I'm glad he did. But again,
right.
So these are easy things to prepare for. So you need to stand up strongly. And in my hope is, of course, that Joe Biden will say, we will not cut Social Security at all. We stand up for women's rights. We will not do this, and point out what Paul Ryan did. And the key thing he needs to do, which people forget, in 1988, had people voted for, based on VP, Lloyd Benson probably would have won. All right? People vote based upon the guy at the top of the ticket.
Right.
Every attack on Paul Ryan and his stupid budget and the rest needs to be tied to Mitt Romney.
Right.
He needs to say, your budget, which cuts this from that, which Mitt Romney supports, which is the Mitt Romney-Paul Ryan plan, which, and I still think he should even use that setup that my wife said. You know, let's talk about your running mate, Mitt Romney, the difference between the one we see in public and the one behind closed doors. The one behind closed doors that thinks 47% of us don't exist and are worthless. The one out in public who seems to pretend he actually cares about us. The one behind closed doors who's sitting down with you, Mr. Ryan, and planning to voucherize Medicare. Or the one in public who claims he actually wants to protect Medicare. On and on.
I'm going to add something to that.
Please do.
I think he should also be tying Ryan to the Republicans in the House.
Aiken. Aiken's pretty toxic.
But
right
also
now.
Tie them to Ryan.
Yeah.
Because you want, I mean, the reason why we got this story here that, you know, Democrats showered districts across the country with TV ads showcasing Ryan and portraying Republicans as cold-blooded bureaucrats who want to do with it. In August and September, 27 of the 51 ads the DCCC aired focused on Medicare. The impact has been scattered. And I really think the reason why that impact of that has been scattered is because you have not seen President Obama and Vice President Biden
stand up.
Make this an issue at the 25,000 feet level, where it is sort of just showering this sort of mist down upon all of these races, where it is contextualizing and framing all these individual House races, all these individual Senate races to a certain extent, but more so the House races, because this is the frame in which these houses, these races exist. And
I want to say, though, quickly, I haven't read the Politico piece, so I need to do that.
Well, I'm sure it's, some of it's BS. But
well,
I'm
I was
sure.
going to say, because, you know, it was for one of the PACs that I'm working with right now. I'm working on about 15 House races around the country, swing districts, and I'll say in general, I've seen when we go on the offense on Medicare, it benefits our candidates.
Oh, definitely, I think they're talking about they thought that there was going to be it was going to be a silver bullet, and I think that it could have been. I think it definitely, if there was a broader narrative about this on a national level. You know, part of the reason why, you know, President Obama has been got in trouble a little bit with this, you know, the Romney, because this is the Romney that you and I were talking about a year and a couple months ago when we were saying, I'm convinced that if we were to go back and listen to August 2011, you and I were saying one of those Fridays, President Obama has reason to be worried here. And it was around the time, remember this, Romney put out that ad about the bump in the road.
Yes.
Where President Obama had said something to the effect about the job situation, that there's some bumps in the road or whatever right. It was. And Romney came out with an ad about the bumps in the road and basically focused on the fact that the Obama administration, that there was just not enough. And to be fair, it's not just the Obama administration at that point. I don't think they had actually even offered the American Jobs Act. I think that didn't come until a month or two later. But which I think also explains probably why it came at that time. Because if we were sensing this as an issue, surely they were. And we were like, you know, if Romney runs in just this way, if he, Romney can actually be on the left, at least in terms of populist rhetoric from President Obama, on the left, like we need to be doing more about jobs and stay there, this guy could win. Right. And
I remember saying back then, and people brought this up to me because the fortunes have changed so much in Ohio, you're saying that as that quintessential type of economically populist state, at the time, I didn't think Obama could win it. And I don't take that back at all. It's not like I feel like what I feel like is Obama changed in a way that I'll admit I didn't see him changing. Back then, he was never talking about the auto bailout. The backlash against Kasich hadn't started yet on the unions, and Obama and others in Washington weren't giving the unions any support on that. There are a number of things that were going on that made me say, you know, these guys are going to find a way to lose Ohio and be out-populisted, if I can say that, by Mitt Romney, which was just, I couldn't believe it. I was shocked.
Right.
Now, then things, you know, he was talking more about free trade than he was talking about the auto bailout.
Yep.
Now, obviously, they changed their strategy, and they started talking more about things that actually make sense to people, and then there are some factors beyond their control, like John Kasich being the complete jerk that he is, and rubbing it in firefighters and police noses and, you know, whatever. But, you know, that I thought back then that Ohio was almost going to be going to be gone because of the what they seemed like they were campaigning on, what they were talking about, new Democratic pablum, you know what I mean, versus what was going on. It didn't look good.
And so the upside is, of course, is that when surprisingly that Romney that we anticipated could be a problem showed up extremely late in the game.
Right. Well, he just, you know, but the point is he, even, you know, when we start looking at polls again this week, like the march towards stupid statements has already started again. I mean, again, he made a statement that he would support legislatively banning abortion, and then they had to walk it back. And in other words, he even when he has a good debate performance like that, he ends up, just give him a week till he says something stupid that, I mean, that led the NBC Nightly News, you know, the other night.
Right. This is when he's, now, he's basically I mean, to a certain extent, this has been the whole story of the election. You know, we're sitting here saying President Obama didn't raise women's issues once during the debate. He had to have affirmatively did it. He would have had to have not listened to the question and bring it up like every time a politician basically answers any question. But we're sitting here, we're criticizing Obama for not doing it. And then Mitt Romney
finds a way to bring it to the forefront again and get himself in trouble.
It's just unbelievable.
He worries conservatives when he says that, and then he has to make up for it by doubling down twice as much and come out like a right-wing loon on abortion, which is what he had to do to make up for it. And then some of those women that were looking at him during the debate thinking, hey, maybe I could be interested in him, hear that. So
we're going to see, I think, a preview of what President Obama is going to do in the next debate with what Biden does tonight, right? Yeah. And so,
Biden. Did you say Ryan? Biden?
Well, no. We're going to see what President Obama is going to bring up in the next debate is going to be previewed by Biden tonight.
I gotcha.
And so I guess what we're looking for is Biden to come out and say that they're not going to cut Social Security. Come out and say they're not going to cut Medicare.
On a half dozen issues.
I know.
Some of which I work on, some of which I don't. I mean, I don't work on immigration, for example. If they would come out and strongly make a statement in favor of all the contributions undocumented workers make and how they're part of the American dream and how we, you know, and you know.
As opposed to, hey, we, I mean, the problem is, of course, is that
the Kemp-Roth bill for, you know,
well,
talking language nobody understands.
They've deported, you know, the record deportations.
Well, obviously, that's a different thing that's
Right.
It's terrible, but I'm just saying, on immigration, on choice, on all the things that separate their demographic, they're younger, you know, more integrated, their coalition of white liberals, minorities, single women, you know, and obviously you know how I feel, that that it's so obvious if you look at the polling that guns should be one of those too.
Right.
I mean, suburban women and others who are scared of gun violence now because of what's going on, but I don't expect that from them, obviously. You know, but on immigration, on guns, on choice, on birth control, on Social Security and Medicare, I mean, if on like a half dozen on the environment, they come out and make very, very strong statements, I think this thing would be locked up.
All right, well, I guess we will see in about 7 hours, 6 hours. You and I will get together if I can pry myself away from the tables. Tomorrow, you and I will discuss, among other things. I mean, I have a feeling I'm going to end up having like 14 guests tomorrow, but we will definitely find time to discuss, obviously, the debate.
Yes.
Which we're going to discuss this evening hopefully do this live broadcast of.
Do it live! Can't help myself.
Tomorrow, we will discuss what happened the first night we sat down at the tables.
Yes.
That was fun.
You know, I found our friend on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Liberal Lisa.
Yes. Well, that's just a hint, folks. And then we will discuss negative progression in terms of a betting style.
Yes.
Which may or may not be a tragic conversation tomorrow.
We're going to find out.
We'll see.
Will Sam have enough money to get home? Or will he be able to drive home in a limo decked out in a James O'Keefe pimp outfit?
That's right.
We will find out.
That's right. I may actually have to sell my plane ticket tomorrow. So we will see.
Don't worry, folks. I'll put Sam in my luggage. I can get him as far as Cincinnati. The rest of the way, he's on his own.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about I'll be taking some of your phone calls, 646-257-3920. And a couple of these stories, most importantly on this telecom immunity, but also we'll touch on the Benghazi thing. Because I have to say that I sort of had a sense that, we'll talk about it in a minute. All right, let's take this brief musical interlude.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh,
good to be
kidding?
Here on a
thank
Thursday, folks.
All right, we'll be right back after this. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. I am live in Las Vegas, Nevada. Nevada, I believe it is. Folks, I will take your phone call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can also IM me at Majority FM or at any of the IMs you you have, Majority FM on AOL client or on if any other client at MajorityFM@jabber.org. I want to get to this telecom story that really, it's only really been written up by, well, I'm sure somebody else has written up, but Glenn Greenwald reported on this last week. Well, not last week. Today's yesterday. It was yesterday. Today's Thursday. Folks, I've been in Vegas for almost 36 hours. I have lost all sense of time. You all will recall, I imagine, that during the 2000s, the aughts, as it were, we're still in the 2000s, during the aughts, we had a little bit of a situation where the federal government was spying on the phone calls and emails of literally millions of Americans. Or, as apparently we are all referred to, as potential terrorists. We're all potential terrorists, aren't we, folks? I mean, we've all seen the movie Red Dawn. So, who knows in what situation? But I say that only because as we get deeper into this story. So, what had taken place was that sometime in 2005, the New York Times had reported on this massive spying program that was being undertaken by the National Security Agency in total contradiction to laws that had been on the books since the Church Commission in the 1970s. That came out of things like COINTELPRO, where the federal government was spying on Americans. And there was a whole regime that was set up, a whole series of laws that were drafted to make sure that this didn't happen again. To also make sure that phone companies were not involved in this, telecom executives were brought in. Telecom lawyers were brought in so that everything would be explicit and clear and in terms that these corporations could understand. During the 2000s, the Bush administration basically went to outfits like AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, said, we want to spy on your customers. And at the very least, we know that AT&T not only said, no problem, let us build a room for you that'll be exclusively for spying on Americans. We may not call it the spying on Americans room. That would be probably problematic since we know what we're doing is completely against the law. But you've asked us, and, you know, maybe when we want certain, I don't know, wireless spectrums or deregulation or whatever it is, you'll just remember this. Your good friends here at AT&T with the spying room. Now, subsequent to the revelations of this spying, you started having all sorts of lawsuits being brought against. I mean, of course, we're not going to see any criminal proceedings against the these telecommunications companies because, well, that would be, that would hold them accountable in some fashion. So you saw a bunch of lawsuits being filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, by the ACLU, I think a couple other organizations on behalf of clients who had been spied upon. I think it was one case out in the Northwest where people who had been spied on accidentally got the records that they had been spied on. One of the problems with these cases, of course, is you've got to prove your standing before you sue them. And if it has been a secret spying program, you don't know necessarily if you have been a target of a law of a spying campaign. Well, a couple of they found a couple of clients who were able to prove that because just accidentally they got hold of these documents. So as these lawsuits were proceeding and motions filed by the telecommunications companies arguing that in some way this would be this would violate national security, we need to subpoena the U.S. government, all of those mechanisms to stop these proceedings from going forward failed. And so the telecoms ended up basically lobbying up, lawyering up, and paying off, not directly, not in an untoward fashion, leaders in both parties, and particularly on the intelligence committees. Glenn Greenwald cites in particular Jay Rockefeller, who completely backslid on this. Congress in 2008 passed a bill providing these telecommunications companies with retroactive immunity. You remember that, don't you? Basically saying that any lawbreaking that you engage in, and then again, this is not lawbreaking that they didn't, that they weren't aware they were engaging in. They knew they were engaging in this. Judge, and that's not my assessment, that's judge after judge after judge who was hearing these lawsuits. The Congress, with tremendous bipartisan support, including President Obama, provided retroactive immunity for any of these violations by these telecommunications companies. So all of these lawsuits that were being filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, were immediately terminated and dropped because now there was retroactive immunity. Think about this, folks. You commit a crime, you have enough pull with enough congresspeople where they can say, well, you know what? That wasn't a crime anymore. So the EFF and the ACLU then began to file suits challenging the constitutionality of immunity, of the notion of retroactive immunity. Federal courts rejected these claims. And on Tuesday, the Supreme Court basically put the final nail in the coffin by saying that they would not take up this case. So we have here such a sublime, pristine, I'm not sure exactly how to express it, but such an exquisite example of just how deeply rooted the lack of accountability for powerful players in our society is. And, you know, it becomes even more stark when you watch that Eugene Jaraki film. Or I guess in my case, it becomes even more stark just having just watched that last week. And you see, you know, guys who used meth for, you know, possessing meth. No other crimes. And they're in jail for 30, 40 years. I mean, it's just absurd. And Greenwald goes on to talk about the corporate media, which basically dismisses this whole episode as civil libertarian types getting all worked up about the wiretapping of potential terrorists, which gets us back to the notion that we are all potential terrorists, according to the media. if the government chooses to wiretap. And this is basically also the definition of signature strikes, too. If you've been hit by a drone missile, then by definition, you were probably a militant. If you have been spied upon by the U.S. government and their corporate lackeys, or vice versa, as the case may be, then you are, in fact, a potential terrorist. Now, I think it's been well-founded for most of the people who listen to this program. But for the rest of Americans, that's going to come in as a big surprise. So, meanwhile, number 646-257-3920. I'll take your phone calls as they come in. But first off, I want to play this. This is an extraordinary piece of tape from Soledad O'Brien on CNN. Now, as you know right now, Darrell Issa has been holding hearings on the attack in Benghazi, which led to the deaths of our ambassador to Libya and three other embassy personnel. One of whom, I guess, Mitt Romney, was going around talking about how he had met at a party in California. Apparently, Mitt Romney has had to stop talking about this because the victim's mother said, please stop doing this. And apparently the victim's best friend was like, I remember when Mitt Romney had met my friend. My friend said he was amazed at what a tool Mitt Romney was. And Mitt Romney kept asking him his name over and over again. And what do you got there? What do you got, Cliff?
Tim Kaine is sitting up at this rally yesterday saying he's not going to cut Social Security. We should raise the payroll tax. Can you get it on your show?
What, can I do it right now?
Yep.
Send me a link and I'll see if I can play it. Oh, yeah, you know what? IM it to me on my IM. We have a situation where in Benghazi, anyways, the State Department has now made clear that there was, in fact, no protest about the film in Benghazi. Now, I have to give myself some credit here because I always thought that was very strange. And I always thought to the extent that there was any protest of a film there, it would have been just simply a ruse by this militant group in Libya that wanted to attack. It's not really the embassy. It was actually just a consulate, or not even an official consulate yet. And that was part of the problem, frankly. That it just didn't make sense that in Libya they would be up in arms about this so quickly. I understood why Egypt, because it was broadcast in Egypt, and I got the idea that Libya and Egypt are next door to each other, but nevertheless. So it turns out the State Department says that we had never concluded that it was part of a protest. The administration, of course, and particularly the UN Secretary Rice, had said that there was a protest. So there was a clear breakdown in communication, all of which is, I guess, only problematic to the extent that it happened after the fact. Prior to the time, there's a lot of questioning as to why Ambassador Stevens was not given more security and more protection. I've heard competing stories that maybe not necessarily are mutually exclusive, that the State Department did not want to or did not have the resources to provide extra security, that Ambassador Stevens did not want to be ensconced in a high-walled, barriered consulate. He had moved to Benghazi because he wanted to be at the center of where the Libyan free government essentially started. They were in a, at least a fairly temporary or new facility that was not built to be an embassy. It was simply like, I think it was like an old school or something to that effect. But what's really stunning is this Republican Chaffetz, who sits on this Daryl Issa committee, on CNN yesterday, both blasting the administration for not providing more security and defending the fact that they wouldn't authorize the funds for more security. Here's that clip now. Hopefully this will play.
Is it true that you voted to cut the funding for embassy security?
Absolutely. Look, we have to make priorities and choices in this country. We have, think about this, 15,000 contractors in Iraq. We have more than 6,000 contractors, a private army there for President Obama in Baghdad. And we're talking about, can we get 24 or so people into Libya to help protect our forces? When you're in tough economic times, you have to make difficult choices.
Okay,
you have to prioritize
things. So you're prioritizing. So when there are complaints that, in fact, that there was not enough security, you've just said absolutely that you cut. You were the one to vote against, you know, to increase security for the State Department, which would lead directly to Benghazi. That seems like you're saying you have a hand in the responsibility to this, right? The funding of the security, if you're happy to cut it.
You get it. But because there are literally close to 200 embassies, consulates, those types of things. You have thousands of people that are involved in this. You have to prioritize things. Libya, before 9/11, two bombings on our consulate out there. Of course, that's got to be a higher priority than making sure that we're protecting,
but if there's pressure,
some other emphasis.
We just heard that from the clip from one of the guys who's going to testify before you today that there was definitely this pressure in his mind to not staff the embassy fully security-wise. Wouldn't that pressure be coming from you directly, essentially, people and others who voted against funding for security? Keep it low because there's no funding for security.
Well, you're also talking about a vote that never came to fruition because we actually continued at the exact same funding levels moving forward. This is a vote that happened over in the House. But remember, the Senate never got to this point, so we did a continuing resolution. So it's a red herring. The reality is you have to prioritize things. And when you're talking about such a small, small number of security personnel, they're in country. That's a problem. The other thing that we're going to talk about in this hearing is the fact that the physical facilities themselves did not meet the minimum standards. And when you're in Libya after a revolution, I've got to argue that that's got to be a higher priority than protecting some other, you know, compound in Mauritius or wherever you might be. I don't mean to pick on them, but you've got to prioritize things. And what clearly didn't happen is Libya was not a priority. I believe what I've heard is that it's because they wanted the appearance of normalization. That's what they wanted. That fit the Obama narrative moving forward.
It'll be interesting to see what comes out of your hearing today. Nice to see you, as always. Thank you for talking with
us. Thanks,
appreciate it.
So here you have Representative Chaffetz first arguing that the State Department wasn't prioritizing it that well to try and excuse his vote on why he had to cut. Didn't want to increase the budget for security for the State Department. And then he falls back on that old chestnut. Well, the Senate didn't pass it anyways, so my vote didn't count. Unbelievable. Really stunning. So did you send me that Tim Kaine thing?
I did.
Let's see what we got here. All right.
Two of them. That's the second one, I think, on Medicare, but he's got a strong one.
All right, so here's Tim Kaine, and he is...
The first one is Social Security. The second
well, but he's not the DNC chief now, is he? Isn't he running foreign...
Obama appointed.
Okay, so here you have... Okay. Here's a clip that Cliff just gave me, apropos to our conversation of Tim Kaine running for Senate... Against Monsieur Makaka. Isn't that...
Monsieur Georges Alain.
Monsieur Makaka.
Part French.
And
all Southern cowboy.
There you go. Here's Tim Kaine addressing Social Security and Medicare. on October 10th, that would be yesterday, on Social Security and Medicare. I mean, I don't know why this isn't a winning formula at the top of the ticket, but it seems to be in terms of the Senate. What? How's his race going?
He's up by about 4 or 5 points.
Up by 4 or 5 points. Let's see. And I don't, you know, I'm not particularly the biggest Tim Kaine fan, but you take it where you can get it, folks.
Yeah, right.
Believe me, I'm in Vegas. I know. All right, here's Tim Kaine addressing Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid advocates in Fairfax. Here we go. What does that mean, though? He said perennial views, tweaks, and adjustments.
Perennial views, tweaks, and adjustments.
Yeah, you didn't catch that part.
No, I didn't.
All right, apparently the audio is not coming through. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that. Apparently, there's no audio. Oh. Oi. Okay. For some reason, the audio is not coming through. I don't understand why that's the case. It should have been. Okay, so Matt, you can hear me, though. Tell me something. Can you hear this audio?
Social Security is contributing to the deficit. No, it's not. Social Security is separately funded. You'll hear folks sometimes advance the notion that Social Security is part of our nation's deficit problem. It's just not true. I favor, as a first step, as we look at Social Security going forward, just look at the payroll tax gap and let that adjust up modestly. That is a means of keeping the program solvent going forward that would be far preferable than privatization or other dramatic transformations of the program. For as bad as the recession was, can you imagine how bad it would have been had we gone down the path of Social Security privatization when the stock market collapsed? Would have been absolutely horrible. And a whole lot of people who have counted on Social Security and Medicare to be that safety net for their retirement would have been in dire, dire straits. But we've got to have this bedrock. We've got to have the bedrock of a Social Security program that people can count on. But the first thing we have to do, you know, that Hippocratic oath, first do no harm. The first thing we need to do is protect the bedrock. And you can be darn sure if I'm in the U.S. Senate, if I have the fortune to be in the U.S. Senate, I will be doing that. Every time I'm on Capitol Hill, I will fight tooth and nail to protect these programs which are relied on to such a significant degree.
All right, well, that's encouraging to hear Tim Kaine talk that way about Social Security. I'm sorry, folks. I understand that you did not hear the audio of Chaffetz, which, of course, is a problem. Oh, boy. All right. Sorry about that, folks. We will add that to the podcast. All right. So the number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the phone number if you want to be part of the program. And let's go to the IMs. Bush in chains. Hey, like Nazi Germany, King Lakudnik's private New York PD, Gestapo stop and frisk, black teen for being an effing... Oh, yeah, we'll put that video on the site. Germany to re-legalize male genital mutilation. I wonder what P-Brain religious lobbying group got their way on this one. I think you're talking about circumcision. It's actually, a lot of people say it's very helpful in terms of infections. I don't advocate the oral biting off. be that as it may. Okay, Apple's BS court rulings are falling apart under appeal. Samsung can resume selling Galaxy Nexus, appeals court says. Serial killer psychopath. Obama's body count continues to rise. U.S. drone strike, says Bush in chains. Hey, Sam, now that you've been given your swing state machine voting orders by often-quoted Noam Chomsky, I guess you're going to be green like me. Too bad you've acquiesced to monarchy. Not to worry, just like economics, if you need help in the basic of activism and democracy, just send me an email. I'm still waiting for you to do something other than send a link of video, which is inconsistent with what you've expressed. But I've said from the very beginning that when I'm talking about voting, I'm talking as if I'm not in a blue state like New York. When I go into the voting booth on voting day, my guess is that President Obama is not going to need my vote, that I can make the calculation just like Chomsky has said. I'm going to make a determination as to what the impact of my vote will have. And if I make the determination that it in no way could lead to a Romney victory, and I will act accordingly. Gold, there, I'm a terrorist. Ryan endorsed Republican, said some girls... Yeah, this story is unbelievable. I don't know what is wrong with these people. A Wisconsin state representative endorsed by Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan told a reporter that he believes some girls rape so easy. This guy, Roger Rivard, later insisted he was merely recounting a story from his father about the dangers men face in having premarital sex. Instead, he somehow wandered into a jaw-dropping commentary on how easy it is to accidentally rape women. This is from the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel. He also told me one thing. I guess this is Rivard speaking, saying this is what his dad told him. If you do have premarital sex, just remember consensual sex can turn into rape in an awful hurry. Because all of a sudden a young lady gets pregnant and the parents are madder than a wet hen. And she's not going to say, oh, yeah, it was part of the program. All that she has to say is that her parents have to say that it was rape because she's underage. And he just said, remember, Roger, if you go down that road, some girls, they rape so easy. What the whole genesis of it was advice to me, telling me if you're going to down that road, you may have consensual sex that might, and then the next morning it might be rape. So he said it was, just remember, Roger, some girls, they rape so easy, it may be rape the next morning. Look, it's not hard for me to imagine that 75 years ago or 60 years ago or whatever it was, 50 years ago, some hayseed in Wisconsin had this mentality. Here's my question. Why in the world would you, as a state representative running for office, relay this story? I got news for you, folks. People have said things to me that I have not relayed. My parents have said things to me that I have not relayed to people. Because, you know what? I either knew it was wrong, I thought it was offensive, or whatever. I can think of one thing that my dad said once. And I can think of one thing that my step-grandfather said to me once. And I don't repeat them to people unless I really want to disparage them, which I do in certain instances. But I wouldn't. What is the value of repeating that as you're running for office? That's shocking. Oh, and then I guess congratulations, Paul Ryan dropped support for him today. So good for Paul Ryan. Coming out strong against the notion that some girls rape so easy. Wonderful. All right, let's go to... LR, the only access through, I'm not sure what you guys are up to, but we're getting long stretches of dead air. Yes, okay. King Bloomberg loses round in court Wednesday, says the missing link. Federal court denied New York City's attempt to appeal the lawsuit against the New York Police Department's stop and frisk policy. The decision allows the case to proceed unhindered at a time when organized opposition to the policy has reached a fevered pitch, and a new bill introduced in the state legislature Wednesday seeks to create an independent inspector general to oversee the NYPD. That's good news. Very good news. All right, let's go to...
Yeah, I hear you.
Jermo, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Sammy.
How's it going?
Good and clear. Good, great. I can't wait for tonight, Sam.
Looking forward to it ourselves, Jermo.
We got a new popcorn maker, and I think Biden's going to do very, very well. He's going to take a few punches, but he's going to give the knockout punch. Wait and see, Sam. I guarantee it.
Well, you seem to be very.
I like
excited.
Joe Biden. He's got a big mouth, but he's not afraid. He's got no fear. Sammy, you sound really good. I can hear you on my telephone. You're sounding great.
Great.
Have a good time. It's good to have a good time. Enjoy yourself.
All right. Well, I'll talk about the time I'm having tomorrow. But I appreciate the call, Jermo.
But Sammy, be good. No funny business.
Don't worry,
Jermo. You got that, Sam?
Yeah.
Okay. Take care now.
Okay. Bye bye. Oh boy, Jermo, ladies and gentlemen. Hi. Who's this? I can't tell who's calling.
This is Pam in San Francisco.
Hi, Pam. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
I'm a little bit puzzled about the security for the ambassador in Libya.
Uh-huh.
Isn't the whole foundation of, like, having embassies and ambassadors, the entire concept built on that the host countries protect the embassies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, at least the outside. I mean, yes, there was a total breakdown, a total failure. I mean, look, it's unclear how many people, security personnel, you could have put into that building that if it would have made a difference or not. You know, if you had put another half dozen people in there, which would have been a lot, but if you had put another half dozen security personnel in there, would it have made a difference? Maybe you would have had a half dozen people die. It's hard to know because they didn't have much time because the place was not fortified specifically for I think specific reasons on behalf of the ambassador's wishes, but also because there was no time essentially to fortify this place. And yes, the Libyan government failed, but of course this was a very volatile situation. Libya is yet to build any type of real sort of like strong civil structure, as far as I can tell, and they had all these competing militias there. Now, we should also remember that in the days following, the civilian population drove this militia basically out of Benghazi. That's little consolation in terms of the people who were killed, but at least there is a sense in terms of the stability of Libya that's at least somewhat encouraging.
Yeah, and I mean, it's tragic that they died, but it was, you know, we did have a lot of knowledge, and the ambassador as an individual had a lot of knowledge about the situation in Libya and what was safer and what was less safe. I mean, it seems to me like the focusing on the security that the U.S. provided, you know, sort of takes us down the road to saying, well, we should have little armies in all of our embassies all over the world.
Right.
And we wouldn't tolerate that from other countries. It's like creating a new kind of American exceptionalism.
Well, of course. And, you know, Pam, you know this is all about the election, too, right? I mean, we're going to hear this. I think we're going to hear the words Benghazi in Libya from Paul Ryan tonight. My guess would be somewhere between 3 and 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you're right, Pam, and you bring up a very good point. And, you know, I think this is one area where it's going to be interesting to see because, you know, Paul Ryan, what did he say his foreign policy experience was? Voting to authorize the war in Iraq? So I don't know. I think, you know, Joe Biden is one of those guys that I think of all the things that he could be talking about, foreign policy is one where he is well-versed. So it'll be interesting to see at least tonight. But I appreciate the
call. Yeah, I like Biden. I'm looking forward to watching the debate tonight.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, tune in, Pam. Much. We should be covering it live. Cliff and I.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
And by should, I mean we intend to, but who knows if we'll be able to. But I assume we will be able to. Calling from a 773 area code, who's this?
Hey, it's Dave in Chicago.
Hey, Dave. Good, how you doing?
I'm all right, man. And look, I'm real jealous of you, man. I wish I was in Vegas just to watch that debate, too. But have fun for me.
All right. Well, you can listen to us. We'll be we should be live streaming it, and with our commentary.
Sure, definitely. Listen, man. I wanted to just touch base. To me, what there's a proposed amendment for the Illinois State Constitution, and the reason why I felt like it was really important to, you know, talk about it was because there's a proposed amendment in the Michigan State Constitution that's pro collective bargaining, it's a big deal over there in Michigan, you know, because of the emergency managers law,
right.
You know, and all that kind of, the attacks on democracy and stuff. So this is kind of enshrining collective bargaining back into the Constitution in Michigan. And in the state of Illinois, we've got the worst underfunded pension program in the country now. And basically the people who work for the state, they negotiate a contract, they pay into the pension, and then, you know, there's a copay from the state or whatever. But the politicians have been taking the money that's supposed to go into pensions and not putting it into the pension fund.
Right.
So it's underfunded. And they're doing this huge, for years now, propaganda campaign against the state employees. Like, I'm talking about at the county hospital, the guy that empties the bedpan that you bark on, that guy is the guy whose pensions isn't funded, you know? All right, or teachers, or social workers, or bus drivers, or whatever. Anyway, so this proposed amendment to the Constitution in Illinois against the pensions, it says that you need a supermajority in order to raise the benefits, but you only need a simple majority to lower them.
Uh-huh.
All right, so it's anti-democratic at its very core. It passed the House, the Senate, and the governorship are all held by the Democrats. And it passed unanimously in the House and with two no votes in the state Senate.
Wow.
The co-sponsors were like the two most important Democrats in the House and Senate in Illinois. And this is, to me, this is something that I think you should come back to over and over again, along with your grand bargain wants and stuff. Like, I think the attack on democracy is so fundamental.
Well,
and here's a good example of the state of Illinois that the Democrats are just attacking.
Dave, I mean, the real issue here is, yes, there's a certain anti-democratic quality to it when you put a different bar for raising benefits to lowering benefits, but really what it is a mechanism in which to attack public sector workers. And, I mean, that's really the issue. And that's why when I was talking to Cliff earlier about the perception in Ohio that the Democrats are that much better in terms of unions. Unions, you know, it's a function of just how bad the Republicans are. I think I'm going to. So, Dave, I got to jump, but you're right about that, and that's something we can focus on more after.
Well,
go ahead.
I would draw one line to say why I think it's. Yeah, I think you're correct, but I also think my position is correct, too. The same thing in the state of Illinois. They passed a law that said that the Chicago Teachers Union needed a much higher bar in order to authorize a strike vote, to have a strike vote that authorizes a strike. And that's fundamentally anti-democratic, not just because it said that in the state, at the state level, to hurt their bargaining and to reduce benefits, but also because it puts a higher bar on democracy within the unions. You know?
Uh-huh.
So, hey, man, thanks a lot. Have fun. I'll listen to you tonight.
Okay.
Keep rocking.
Great.
All right, Thanks, man.
Dave. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Give me a second here. We're going to bring in a guest who you may recognize from the film Hot Coffee. I think it was last year at this conference. I had a chance to sit down with Susan Saladoff, who is the director of Hot Coffee. And one of the stories that she recounted, or I guess was told in the documentary, was of essentially attacks on a judge in Mississippi. In Mississippi, of course, the judges on the state Supreme Court are elected. And the Chamber of Commerce really, as part of their broader agenda to limit access to courts for regular people, I guess, to tip the balance of power further on the side of corporations versus individuals, really wanted to take out a specific judge because they were afraid that he didn't subscribe to that perspective. That judge was Judge Oliver, is it Diaz?
Yes, it's Oliver Diaz.
And he is sitting with me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on this morning.
So Judge, can you just relate a little bit more of your story for folks who may not remember?
Yeah, well, In the year 2000, it was the Bush versus Gore election, everybody remembers, but I was running for Supreme Court in Mississippi at that same time. And as I was running, just before the election, about 2 weeks before Election Day, we noticed these massive amounts of campaign ad buys being made in Mississippi. And we looked into it, and they were being made by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It was actually in their name, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they were saying all sorts of horrible things about me. And it was just blindsided. They caught us completely off guard. And so what we found out after doing a little more research was this wasn't unusual. They decided that at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that they were going to get involved in judicial elections. And they especially focused on smaller states at the time because they recognized the potential. Actually, Karl Rove was the mastermind behind this. He had done this in Texas, and he had done it also in Alabama. But he decided to branch out and do this in all and many other states. And Mississippi was one of the states that he chose at the time.
And I imagine in the context of Citizens United and super PACs, that this money, that this trend has now increased across the country.
Yeah, this is only going to get worse. This was all pre-Citizens United, so the amount of campaign funds are going to be even increased. And we're seeing it this year in Florida. I don't know if many folks are familiar with what's going on, but Florida has retention elections. They don't have actually contested judicial elections, but they have retention elections.
What does that mean, retention elections? Were there like a referendum as to whether or not the judge stays on there or not?
Exactly. The Florida Supreme Court, the judges every so many years have to stand for election, just a yes or no as to whether or not they can continue to serve. Up until now, it's historically been pretty much a perfunctory election. Unless the judge had done something horrible, they were routinely reaffirmed through the retention process. This year, the Republican Party in Florida has taken a stand that they're going to mount massive campaigns against the three judges who are up for retention in Florida. The Republican Party is behind it. They are open and obvious. They're announcing it publicly. The attorneys groups in the state are up in arms because they want, as everybody should, they want judicial decision-making to be nonpartisan, to be fair. We don't want partisan judges, and that's what we need to strive for is fairness and judicial impartiality. But that's not what the Republican Party in Florida wants, and it's not what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce around the country want. They want partisan judges who are going to maintain the partisan corporate agenda that they're pushing throughout the entire United States. this is, you know, I hate to say, sound alarmist. I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. But this is an attempt to take over the judicial process, the judicial system of the United States of America. And they're doing it at the state level through elections, both elections and retentions. And they're doing it on a national level through the appointment process.
Yeah, just give me a sense of what kind of... Now, when they attacked you in Mississippi, they basically threw the kitchen sink at you in terms of including criminal charges and, in fact, I think Paul Miner was discussed in the movie, was a trial lawyer, I think is still in prison. Is that right?
Yes, he is. Paul is a very dear friend of mine. He's a trial lawyer in Mississippi. He made a lot of money practicing law, representing plaintiffs. He was in asbestos litigation, and he was one of the leaders in the tobacco litigation nationwide. He used his money to support Democratic candidates. He actually was the single largest Democratic donor in the state of Mississippi and one of the top Democratic donors in the United States of America. And so... When I was attacked, it was more because of my supporters. I think I don't think it was necessarily because of me, but it was about my supporters. They wanted to cut off the Democratic funding in the state of Mississippi and to have an effect on Democratic campaign spending throughout the United States. And they certainly did in this case when they brought a prosecution against myself and Paul Miner. It was bribery allegations. The problem that they had was I had never voted on any of Paul's cases that he'd had before me at the Mississippi Supreme Court, and as a result, they couldn't make out any charges against me. A jury acquitted me in a very short amount of time, and so that was frustrated at that point. Their plans were frustrated because of that.
And so, as a judge, what are the types of cases that the Chamber of Commerce would have a problem with your perspective? I mean, when they talk about an agenda, and particularly in the context of tort reform, I don't think that people understand that there are two types of things that probably the chamber wants. Chamber wants victories in specific cases, obviously, to favor corporations, but they also want a broader type of reform, either statutorily or in terms of process, which is determined by the courts, right? I mean, just flesh that out for us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Think of corporations. They're only interested in one thing. They're not interested in justice. They're not interested in fairness. They're interested in making profits. And anything that affects the profits or the bottom line of a corporation, they're going to oppose, and they're going to oppose strenuously.
Their board of directors has a fiduciary responsibility for that. I mean, they are basically sharks. In the same way sharks live to eat, this is what the corporation does.
No doubt about it. And that's one of the fallacies with Citizens United, with the Supreme Court saying that corporations are persons. They're not persons. Persons care about fairness. People care about individual justice. Corporations don't care. They care about making a profit. And anything that affects that profit is going to be attacked by a corporation. And they see judges who do not vote the corporate line. If you vote against corporate interests, say you're awarding judgments to plaintiffs, if you make a decision that affects their shareholders, they're going to attack that judge. This is not what a normal person, as you would say, would do, but this is what a corporation does. That's why it's difficult to imagine the U.S. Supreme Court calling a corporation a person. They're not people. They're not persons. They have one motivation, and that's money.
Give me another sense of where we're seeing these type of the chamber involved in that. I mean, what elections do you anticipate in terms of judges are the ones that the chamber across the country are focusing on? You mentioned Florida. Are there other states that they and how many states actually elect their judges?
Well, actually, most states elect their judges. I don't know the exact percentage, but it's upwards of 75% of all judges are elected in some form, whether it's direct elections or retention elections. So most judges are affected by elections across the country. And, you know, what Karl Rove recognized, and he said this is one of his quotes, he said, "A couple of $1 million in unanswered ads has a tremendous effect on an election." And his tremendous effect is not necessarily in the best interest of the citizens. He recognized that we all see these negative ads all across the country. You see it with President Obama and Mitt Romney. They're attacking each other viciously with these ads from independent groups and from each other. The difference between these ads on the national level with presidential candidates and with judges are that, despite the fact that judges think that they're very well-known and popular in their states, their judges are largely unknown.
Right.
So if you start advertising in a judicial election, you have the ability to influence significantly the perception of that judge. Basically, you get to paint the picture of the judge that you want. And judges without a constituency, we're in Mississippi, we're nonpartisan.
Right.
In Florida, like I talked about before, it's retention elections. You don't have the party apparatus behind you. You don't have the money to fight back. And when they start launching these ads, the public, this is the only information the public has about this judge, are these negative ads that they're seeing on television.
That's fascinating. It had never occurred to me, but I mean, that essentially was the strategy that the Obama campaign used on Mitt Romney over the course of the summer. Let's define him first. But this is exponential. I mean, they were able to define Mitt Romney first, a guy who's been running for president for 8 years.
Yes.
I doubt that there is, I certainly couldn't tell you who the Supreme Court justices of New York or Massachusetts are, and the state Supreme Court justices.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I would say I'm probably in a, at least the top 5 or 10 percentile of lay people who should know this type of thing. I can only imagine if there was a $1 million ad campaign in New York State, even. $1 million in Mississippi is going to go a lot further in terms.
I found out that it does.
I would imagine just defining a judge, first introducing the judge, and then saying, here's why you should know about this guy or woman, it would be devastating.
Yeah, exactly. And as you mentioned, I mean, Mitt Romney had the ability to fight back with his own advertising and try to define himself a bit. But
you, as a judge, do not have $1 million campaign war chest to fight back against this, particularly if you have no idea it's coming.
Exactly. That's right. And what's even more interesting is we talked about what corporations are interested in. They're interested in these civil cases, plaintiff's decision and things like that. But that's not what they focus on. We've seen in ads state after state, what they will do is pick out usually criminal decisions that the judge has made. In my case, that's what they did. They had these ads saying that I'd taken money from trial lawyers, and they actually showed these money bags landing on a judicial bench, and they said that one of my decisions allowed a drug dealer to walk free. Well, as an appellate judge, I mean, that's my job. If there was an error in the trial, we're supposed to overturn the verdict.
Right.
And an appellate judge, we don't do it. One judge doesn't make that decision either. In Mississippi, there are nine judges on the Supreme Court, so I was one of five that voted that way. And so they had these ads saying I was receiving this massive amount of money, and we attempted to hide these ads. My kids were very young at the time, and we didn't want them to see all these horrible things they were saying about their dad, you know, taking all this,
right,
this money. So we sort of kept the television off for a long time as we were getting ready for school in the morning, right before the election time. And one morning we woke up, and my little daughter was yelling, jumping up and down in the house. She said, "Woo, yay, Daddy, Daddy, we're rich. You got lots of money people are giving you." So the ads didn't have the effect that they wanted on my daughter, but they were certainly pretty devastating in the campaign.
Well, Judge Oliver Diaz, thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with us today. And good luck at the conference.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
All right, great. All right, folks, a couple more IMs. Are going to go a little bit late today. I'm happy now. Sam, you nailed the debate. That other guy seemed info challenged. You were very deaf, though. You're talking about the Drunk with Bob. Sam, what time do your coverage start tonight? I would imagine we're going to start about 15 minutes before the debate. We got to just figure it out. But check the blog for more info and my tweets. Interesting note to Daily Kos says Adam Bomb 99 has been tightening up with conversation about the president's intentions, lighting up with conversations about the intentions of Social Security. Fans seem to be getting agitated about it, going into excessive defense mode. They ignored this conversation ever since the first debt deal was spiked. Crystal Cloud, Sammy, hey, listen, how are you, Sammy? Listen, no funny business in Sin City. Okay, Sammy, no hanky-panky under that full city. I know what you mean, Sam, but real quick, Sam, one thing. Hey, Cliff thinks it's a Social Security messaging problem. You said it. The Democratic message, as clear as can be, Sammy, they're cutting it first chance they get. Obama, Brahman, Lincoln, says, okay, I'll let you go, Sammy. Bye. I think Crystal Cloud is channeling Jeremo. Interesting to note, Ocoz, by the way, as in Marcos, not Coz. Thank you. Coz. Big Mosquito, thank you. BF1800, Sam, I just called in and spoke to you during that call. I heard you much more clearly than I did other times I've called in. I don't know how you tweak the phone setup for Vegas, but if you can do it... your show office, that'd be wonderful. Clarity today was excellent. Big improvement. Normally there's a little cutting in and out when you talk. Huh. Maybe we need more bandwidth. I don't know. That's strange. Not sure what that's a function of. Okay, thank you for the... CoolJ146. Can you interview someone who could talk about the Spectra pipeline in New York City and efforts to stop its construction? Send me an email about that. Neo-Nazi Party sets up New York office. Golden Dawn neo-fascists looking to set up New York office. On a positive note, Anonymous shut down their website almost instantly. It's been down for 3 weeks. Also, encouragingly, Queens politicians and locals, local Occupy outposts have been mobilizing against them. All right, folks. That is our program for today. You can catch us later tonight. Cliff and I will be doing some debate roundup. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff will be joining me. Hopefully we'll get Carl Frisch on tomorrow, who's in the house. And maybe we can get Tom Hartman, who's out here as well. Until then. This is going to be a freebie Thursday, I guess. And so if you have the ability, folks, to become a Majority Report member, please do. You can become a member at majority.fm. Many ways to support the show. Obviously, go to majority.fm/support the show. Find out how you can support the show. Do not let the corporate media be the only media. See you tomorrow.